Minnesota Reads is supported in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. This morning, joining us on the line is William Green. He's the author of a book called Nellie Francis, Fighting for Racial Injustice and Women's Equality in Minnesota. Hey, Bill, good morning, and thanks so much for being our guest this morning.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me.
I was thrilled to discover, even though it's goofy, that my life overlapped Nellie Francis's life. Even though
really?
It was a couple of years, it was probably only a couple of years, and I was an infant and wasn't, you know, had not really engaged much in terms of, you know, civic engagement and involvement. But my life overlapped hers a little bit. She sounds like such an amazing person. And perhaps not surprisingly, most people haven't heard about Nellie Francis. Can you remedy that for us?
Well, it's understandable. Few people talked about or knew anything about her contribution. She was born in Nashville in 1874, but came to Minnesota with her family in 1885, and was pretty much involved in her community, the African American community, and in particular her church, until the turn of the century. She was chiefly known for being one of the leaders of the women's suffrage movement in Minnesota. Was a national leader of the Association for Colored Women's Clubs, a national leader in that capacity, and also in the wake of the lynching of three black men in Duluth in 1920, she drafted the legislation and lobbied the legislature to pass Minnesota's anti-lynching law. So she was a pretty active person. And it is sort of surprising that few people know about her, but part of it has to do with the fact that Nellie was not a self-promoter, and she lived at a time where women typically, especially middle-class women, typically lived a fairly quiet life. They didn't draw attention to themselves at what good services and good works they did. They tended to do from behind the scenes. And so when I first started talking about her, it wasn't unusual for me to be faced with that quizzical look in their eyes. Nellie Francis, who's Nellie Francis? But she was an amazing person. And thank you for drawing attention to her. That was what I felt she needed to receive.
One of the things that we've learned is that instead of history being the gospel that we can all take absolutely seriously and lean on and trust, that history is written, you know, you need to look at who wrote it.
How did they fare?
You know, how did they come off in this? I mean, the people who come off as idiots rarely write books about it. people who are vanquished don't always have the opportunity to write a book. And if you are the white colonizer with all the power, it's not surprising that all the history books reflect how great the white colonizers in power are. Nellie Francis, as a woman and as a woman of color, would absolutely be one of those voices that it shouldn't surprise us that we haven't heard anything about, and yet we need to hear about. What were some of your challenges trying to find out more about her life when you couldn't just go to, you know, the Nellie Francis section of the library and pull down four or five exhaustive biographies of her?
Yeah. Well, I think historians, and they are my brethren, tend to validate subjects for potential research by how many volumes and articles have already been written about the person. And so if there is nothing else written about the person, they tend to discard that person because there's no literature already available. I think that what we have to do is look at history as a living study, as something that's constantly evolving. And, you know, mine's the first biography of her, but I hope it's not the last. I can already see other people writing various aspects about her life and making sure that their respective audiences are aware of her. And I think that's the way that history should be done. It is evolving, that we build on the work of previous scholars, that we constantly look at the people from different vantage points. And it begins with an article. It begins with a book. So, you know, we are very human. We as historians are very human and biased, and a little insecure. You know, we tend not to validate any particular topic unless there are a number of footnotes that can be gained from it. And that means that, you know, if people haven't written, then that person doesn't exist. And we know that that's not the way to look at our past. So it's sort of giving ourselves license to presume that there are stories there that other people have missed, and to not think that what we do is the final statement about the person. I'm hoping that my book serves as a springboard for further scholarship.
I'm curious, did Nellie and her husband have any living relatives who had firsthand experience with them, who, you know, had met them and talked with them and perhaps worked alongside them? Did you have the opportunity to talk with any people who had known her personally?
No. She died in 1969. And, you know, like yourself, my life crosses her life in a sense. I mean, I lived in Nashville. I lived at Fisk University. I lived just blocks from where she lived, near her declining years. But knew nothing about her. The thing about Nellie is that she came from a relatively small family, and she, you know, her base, she knew a lot of people, but knew them, it seems, on a professional level. There were very, very few people who had an intimate relationship with her, and I think it goes a little bit to her disposition. She seemed to be an introvert. She seemed to be a person who protected her privacy. And I think for that reason, she did not leave a long track record. Her sister died just a couple years before Nellie left Minnesota to go to Africa. Her mother died a decade before. Her father died in 1899. And so by the time she and Billy left Minnesota permanently, there was no family left in Minnesota. In Nashville, where she relocated, her husband had already passed. He died in Africa. Her aunt, her mother's youngest sister, was still around and very active in Nashville politics. But Nashville might as well have been, you know, on the other side of the globe from St. Paul. There was very little contact between the two communities. Her grandmother, remarkably enough, survived until she was 117 years old, and she was active. But she passed in the 1950s. So by the time Nellie enters her final decade, she's alone. She doesn't really have any intimate relations. She does have some nephews. They're medical doctors and into their own world, and they touched into her life. They made sure she was doing okay, but they didn't have the kind of relationship in which the nephews would be able to hold stories to share with anybody else. So by the time Nellie died, she, for all intents and purposes, was alone. She knew people, but she didn't have the kind of intimate relationships with people that I could tell.
It would be interesting.
That's how she wanted it.
It would be interesting, especially now when social media, it can obviously do a lot of damage, but it can also connect us to people in an amazing way, to find out about members of her church community in St. Paul and to reach out there, because I bet there'd be people that had known her or perhaps had some firsthand stories about Nellie. One of the things I think is so wonderful about doing this kind of work is the way you can uncover a person as you have, and then you want to know more.
Yes.
And I think that's kind of what, you know, that sort of will help to drive academics too. If, you know, I want to read another biography of Nellie Francis. Well, there isn't one. Why not?
Yeah. You're right about that. And what is frustrating in one sense about the work is that, or about Nellie's legacy, is that she didn't leave us with a treasure trove of letters and memoirs. I mean, there are some letters that exist, but unlike some of the more notable figures in our history, she did not leave a biography of herself, or an autobiography, I should say. And I think that oftentimes when people survive a subject by 20 or 30 years, what one remembers is not necessarily what happened, but that is still something to work with. So I agree with you that I hope that there might be a material for an ambitious historian to pick up some of those pieces and try to piece a different chapter or a new chapter on her life by interviewing those who survived her life. I know that when she, I think maybe 4 years before she passed in the 1960s, the women of Nashville held a reception for her. You know, awarding her, giving recognition for her contribution to the community in Nashville, and there was hardly any reference whatsoever to Minnesota, and that's an interesting point because she seemed to be interested in distancing herself from Minnesota. It was not a happy departure, and I think that can obscure certain things, but it doesn't mean that it shouldn't be pursued. The job of a historian and a job of a person doing the research of a past means doing the hard work. It means going, you know, reading the obscure footnotes and you know, hanging out in dusty attics looking for that one or two letters that may exist. I mean, that's what the work requires, and that's really the only way that we can, you know, keep her legacy alive. By doing the hard work. So yeah, I think your invitation for that type of research is exactly where we should be going.
Well, she certainly would not have been the first person to leave Minnesota and feel as though, as a person of color, this isn't a welcoming place. This isn't the right place for me. We hate to think that as Minnesotans because we like our Minnesota nice reputation, and everybody wants, of course, to think of themselves as a nice person. But she wouldn't be the first person of color to say this is not. And of course, having the Ku Klux Klan show up at her home after she and her husband moved into a white neighborhood in St. Paul, that's not going to leave a really, you know, positive taste in your mouth necessarily. But these are the stories that I think perhaps as lifelong Minnesota residents, we need to read, we need to hear, we need to see how this is happening. How could that be? We're so nice. Nah, see well, what you're up to?
Well, the other side to that same story is that her friends, all of her associates, all of the people she worked with in the realm of civic activity, suffrage work, civil rights, community work, community African American, none of those people showed up to defend her for all intents and purposes. And so, you know, part of her decision to leave was also the sense of being misunderstood, being abandoned, being criticized, vilified. In her final speech, it isn't the speech that she gives, but one of the people who does give a speech during that reception finally puts into words, you know, the kind of slings and arrows that she had to experience from her own community. And that's one of the reasons that I think her story is important. One of the reasons, her story illustrates how, you know, the price of being a leader, how high that price is, because oftentimes a person who takes a lead, even if it's in behalf of advancing the interests of the community, can be a target from people in that same community. We saw that happen with King. We saw that happen with Ida Wells. And it's a side of the story that we're not really proud of, which is why it's not widely known. But her life is one of doing the right thing at the expense of being loved by people in several different places, including her own community. So I think that that's an additional challenge to understanding Nellie Francis. She preferred being alone to being widely loved, revered, it seemed. And she didn't come across as a prickly personality, but it's quite the contrary. But she defied convention. You know, she dared to try to make overtures to build bridges between black suffragists and white suffragists and black club women and white club women. And that's, at this time in her life, that was a very unpopular thing to do. She left Minnesota because it wasn't her home anymore. And the people who she thought were allies abandoned her for all intents and purposes, in addition to the Klan burning stuff on her front lawn.
Well, there are the enemies that you know are out there and that you expect. And then there are the enemies that you thought were not your enemies. And
That's exactly right. That
betrayal is so difficult. Bill, I wish we had more time to talk about this, but actually I think I should just concentrate on my reading. Thank you so very, very much for joining us this morning. What a fascinating conversation. Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed this conversation as well. It's a nice way to start the day.
Excellent. Thanks again. William Green is the author of a book called Nellie Francis, Fighting for Racial Justice and Women's Equality in Minnesota. Minnesota Reads on KUMD is supported in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.